Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What really goes on when high-level terrorist suspects are questioned by their CIA captors? And do so-called enhanced interrogation techniques really generate enough useful information to justify the potential damage to rapport with valuable suspects and to America's reputation as a humane and just society? Glenn L. Carl spent 23 years working for the Central Intelligence Agency. He retired in 2007 as Deputy National Intelligence Officer for Transnational Threats. In 2002, Carl was the lead interrogator of an overseas detainee believed to be among the highest-ranking al-Qaeda operatives captured since 9/11. But as he writes in his new book, The Interrogator and Education, Carl discovered that neither the suspect in question nor the growing American legal tolerance for torture could yield what some of his colleagues had expected. Glenn, welcome to Think.
Thank you very much for having me.
Tell us, if you will, what you can about your career with the CIA leading up to 9/11.
Oh, sure. Well, I was what we call an operations officer, and that's what the general public will consider a spy, although we don't use that term. And my job was to work overseas and to convince foreigners to provide America secret information that we, the United States, thought was in our national interest to know.
Mm-hmm. And on 9/11 and immediately following, you were actually working in Washington in a sort of administrative position because you were dealing with some family obligations.
That's pretty much true, yes. I had been in an operational assignment until just about a year before then, and I actually was working on in Washington on developing a leadership program for our officers, which turned out more interesting than I had anticipated.
Now, initially, you were excited when you were called on to take part in this operation overseas, to leave Washington for a bit. Talk about the sort of information that you received about the prisoner that you call Captus in the book before you traveled to meet him for the first time.
Well, I think any operations officer signs on because we want to work overseas and we want to be involved in the issues of the day. And so I, like every American, was angered and heartbroken by the events of 9/11 and wanted to play a role in our response to it, to go and find the people who had done this and to stop them. So I was quite honored that I was being brought into what was viewed as one of the premier coups in our counterterrorism efforts.
And in addition to having a great deal of experience in this sort of thing, will suffice it to say you had language skills that were valuable in this investigation.
Well, they were. There was when the agency captured this fellow whom I call Captus. We actually kidnapped the fellow off the street in the Middle East. It came after a huge amount of work had been put into identifying who he was and why we thought he was a critical member of the al-Qaeda organization. The overlapping, the Venn diagram, if you want, of the characteristics necessary or needed for the operation were someone with very strong language ability in certain language or languages, someone with as much experience as possible, ideally you'd get a very experienced officer, and third, somebody who was available. And when you found the interlacing set of those three criteria, you found that constituted one officer, and that was me.
Mm-hmm. And talk a little bit about the differences and the similarities between dealing as a case officer with the people who actually are the spies that are from other places that are giving information to the United States, which is what you've done in the past, and interrogating a criminal suspect in a terrorist case.
Well, this is what no one in the agency had experience, so far as I am aware, in interrogation. That's not the business that the agency has been in.
Yeah.
There are trained interrogators, or at least professional interrogators, and they're in the FBI or some police forces. But the agency didn't do that. So we needed someone with field experience who could go out and work out how to do this. I found, happily actually, that the skills required to be a good operations officer are identical to those of being a good interrogator. And I also found that my assessment of what those skills were and the approach should be corresponded exactly to the approach that the FBI takes. and that is to develop a rapport with the person, to understand his motivations and fears and hopes, and to try to manipulate them, of course. But it's a human relation and understanding the man sitting across from you. That's the job.
You know, Glenn, that's such a fascinating relationship for those of us who've never had to have anything like it with anyone in our lives, in that both you and the person you're interrogating recognize that you're on opposing sides, and you have to learn to read one another and know when to trust one another. What can you talk specifically about the little things that you do to build a rapport with someone that you think may have committed some really heinous acts?
Well, I used to tell Captus, this fellow, I said, listen, of course, everything I say, you should disbelieve. If I were sitting in your chair, I certainly would. I mean, you're totally helpless. We've taken you off the street, out of your life. You don't exist in the world anymore, except to the extent that I or my masters decide what to do with you. So that's not something that's really conducive to good feelings or trust. Of course you should feel that way. But I will tell you, everything that I say and do will be the truth. And I lived up to that. And now I wasn't Simon Pure to this guy. The job was to get him to talk, and I was manipulative, but I also was straight with him. And I said, you should assess everything I say, and you will find that, one, I'm the only interlocutor you have, and two, you can trust me. And that's why any conversation that we have can be useful to you, Captus.
I want to talk about those first meetings that you had with him. When you arrived in country where he was being questioned by another officer that you call Roger, whose methods seemed ineffective at best and counterproductive, perhaps, at worst.
Well, I think they were actually stupid. I mean, excuse me for that. And Probably I can't say that either, but you know, if one reads the book, I think it becomes clear. Yeah, our instructions were to press this man and get the information from him, to pressure. Well, okay, that's not illegitimate necessarily as an order. But it constituted, in this fellow's mind, that should consist of shouting at the guy, and basically that was it. And that accomplished zero. I just found that it was foolish.
So how were you able to get him removed from the case?
Well, I was a little devious, actually, which I suppose won't surprise the expectations of the listeners, but nonetheless is not quite typical of me. I just essentially said to our superior, I said, listen, this guy has hideous social skills. What he's doing is really foolish. This is getting us not only nowhere, but taking us backwards. And I'm not a trained interrogator, but I am a good case officer, mm-hmm. So you should let me do this and send this guy home. I said it in a slightly less diplomatic language than that, but that's the message that I conveyed, and the fellow, our boss, agreed.
You had some concerns before you even arrived that you might, in fact, based on things that you'd heard, witness detainees being treated in ways that were not humane. Can you talk about how you expressed those concerns and the response that you got?
Oh, absolutely. This not only did I have some concerns, but I was profoundly concerned from the first instant that I was brought into the operation. It was quite clear to me from the first that these were critical issues that I was being confronted with in my career and that the agency and the United States government was confronting. The issue of interrogation and using what we now call enhanced interrogation techniques, the term didn't exist at the time, and what I immediately thought of as torture, was something that I was acutely disturbed by and aware of from the first second. So when I was told, go down to a certain room and you'll be briefed on why we're going to send you overseas for 90 days, that's all that I knew. I walk in and I'm told we've captured one of the top members of Al-Qaeda, and you will be involved in the interrogation, and, quote, you will do whatever it takes to get him to talk. Do you understand? I understood instantaneously, and I was disturbed instantaneously. And my response was, well, we don't do that. Mm-hmm. And the answer was, well, we do now.
And they said, well, we've got presidential dispensation, but in fact what they had was the famous letter from John Yoo.
Yes. Well, my next response was, in this conversation, and this is exactly how the conversation went. I said, well, we would need at least a presidential finding. That's an inside term that means direct presidential authorization and order to conduct a certain operation.
Uh-huh.
It's a very sensitive, very senior thing, and the agency does nothing without clear legal authorization and orders from the executive to conduct these operations. And so something like this, obviously, to me, would require that. And I said, well, we have to have the presidential directive. And the answer was, well, we have it. So I assumed in this conversation, well, we have this formal covert action finding, it's called, you know, that the president finds this is in our national security interest and you are ordered to do X, Y, or Z. In fact, I learned later that we didn't have a finding. And as the Senate Oversight Committees found, I don't think there ever was a finding, because that's a hard thing to obtain and to get through the system to authorize what might well be considered torture by some. So instead, we had the letter drafted by John Yoo in the Justice Department that said, I, the president, find this important and authorize you to do X, Y, or Z.
When you're authorized to do these things, there are not specific methods put out there. It's just sort of go as far as you can possibly go.
Well, particularly in my case, I was involved in the early days of the CIA's and the U.S. government's response to Al-Qaeda post 9/11. So the clear formal protocols of what's authorized, what the techniques should be, what you may do and what you may not go beyond had not yet been evolved formally. And no one was ever told that I'm aware, certainly I never was, you will go out and beat him on the side of the head. Never, 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 never. Mm-hmm. I was told, you will do whatever it takes. Do you understand? Pressure him. And then their pressure on me to pressure him was quite strong, but it was never more explicit than that. The other part of the conversation gave some insight, however, I believe, because I said, I knew the country where this fellow was being held, and I knew it disturbed me because I knew what the country sometimes was reputed to do. And so I said, well, what suppose something happens that I think is unacceptable? And the response was, well, then you leave the room, you won't see what happens, and so far as you know, nothing happened, did it? And at that point I responded, well, I remember thinking, excuse me, I'll use a little vulgar term, I remember thinking, of all times in my career to be a pain in the ass, this is the time. This is not the time just to roll along here. And so I said, well, what about the Geneva Convention? And the answer was, well, which flag do you serve? And so at that point, I realized, you know, either you obey your orders or you're removed from the thing right away.
You said flat out a little while ago that you see enhanced interrogation techniques as absolutely being torture. Do you think the use of euphemisms is nearly as dangerous as the things themselves that we're doing?
Well, let me expand a little bit on, I don't remember exactly my words, but the dilemma for agency officers and for U.S. government people in the post-9/11 response was no one acted, well, in the CIA at least, no one acted without clear authorization. The problem came because the laws and guidance that we were explicitly given contradicted other laws and guidance under which we were obliged to act. So if a presidential order undermines the Constitution, no cruel or unusual punishment, and undermines the Convention Against Torture that the United States is a signatory to and abides by, etc., what do you do? That's the dilemma that we faced. No one acted beyond orders, but the orders became a mishmash and incoherent.
My guest is Glenn L. Carl, former Deputy National Intelligence Officer for Transnational Threats for the CIA. His new book is called The Interrogator, An Education. You can join our conversation now by calling 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a self-designed graduate program that allows you the chance to meet the challenges of society. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Glenn L. Carl. He's a 23-year veteran of the Central Intelligence Agency who retired as Deputy National Intelligence Officer for Transnational Threats. His new book is called The Interrogator and Education. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372. You can also send an email to think@kera.org. Glenn, is there anything like an average session that you would have had with CAPTIS that you can describe in terms of how long it was and the sort of things you discussed and where you started and ended?
Well, yes, I think I can answer that. The sessions were really quite exhausting because one focuses so intensely and they lasted so long. So I would be with CAPTIS for most of the day. I would start early morning-ish and go often until it was dark. So the session could be 12 hours or more. In the sessions, I would sit with him, and it was an incredibly intense experience. I took my job very seriously and thought that I had a chance to save American lives and help destroy al-Qaeda at first. And this man's life was on the line, so both of us were very, very focused. And before going into the interrogation room and meeting, I would meet with my colleagues. There was a whole staff involved in this who were experts in one element of the operation or the case or al-Qaeda or another. And we would work out from telegrams received from headquarters and from our own knowledge what issues would I explore that day. What questions would I raise? How would I build on what we had discussed the day before? And so on. So then I would go in with those questions. And my method, because it was pre-laptop era to a large extent, is to use a steno pad. And I would sit with that balanced on my knee and intensely talk to him all day and say, well, what about the following? And he would answer. And I'd say, well, that doesn't make sense, or thank you, and I'd explore that way. And I'd try to get through the list of infinite questions that we had because we believed him to know a lot of things of relevance to American intelligence. And he did know a lot, actually.
You mentioned that there was an entire staff involved. How much control did you have over the way CAPTIS, your prisoner, was treated when you were not in his presence?
When I was not in his presence?
When he was not in your presence, I should say.
Yeah. Well, that was always an issue because he was being held by a foreign liaison service, another intelligence service for a foreign country. So in my presence, I had, if not control, certainly was aware of what was happening and had great influence. I would say I did have control when I was in his sight. But when he left my sight, I never had control, and we, the CIA, never had ultimate control of him during the time that he was held by this Foreign Intelligence Service. When he was sent to the second site, that was an American one, there he was completely under our control.
I don't know how specifically you can describe this, but talk about how you started to get the very clear sense that while this guy had some information and was certainly not a saint, he was not the high-ranking al-Qaeda operative that you had been led to believe.
Yeah, well, I can certainly describe the arc of my perceptions. I can't give the detailed questions and answers that he and I engaged in. However, I started from the beginning asking some of the questions that I had been given and developed, and I found fundamentally he was answering accurately. Not every time, but most of the time. And some of his answers to my questions, and they might be technical questions about, or questions that about his life or his work or his associates' practices that we could independently verify. Some of the questions we could substantiate later by other sources. Some we could disprove. Overall, I found that he was answering truthfully. Not always. Some things I knew he wouldn't answer. Some things I knew he gave the wrong answer to, but most of the things he answered truthfully. And my job was to assess this man. That's what I did for my career, was to look in someone's eyes and understand, well, why is the person telling the truth or why is the person not telling the truth? And how can I get the person to answer me? And what motivates this man's heart? That's the job. And I found fundamentally he was dealing straight. And so I started to say that. And I also found, critically, that his answers, which we could corroborate, and the assessment that I made, indicated that he was not what we had assessed him to be. He was not the central critical member of Al-Qaeda. And I started to report that and progressively thought, this is not adding up to the way I had been told it would.
It's not what headquarters wanted to hear.
Well, no. I always was, if not the only odd man in the whole operation, certainly the only one I'm really aware of. The institution, the CIA said, look, essentially their position was, we've done years of work with many officers on this. We know all about him, and he's duping you. Mm-hmm. And there came to be this Kafkaesque, crazy dynamic that extended well beyond just my case.
Yeah.
This will sound unbelievable, but it's literally the truth. I said, okay, I asked a certain question he cannot answer. And the response from headquarters was, the fact that he is not answering proves that he is guilty and knows the answer.
Does it make you question yourself, Glenn? Do you think, well, maybe they're right, maybe I've lost my touch here? And even momentarily, do you start to question your own assessments?
Oh, not just momentarily, but every single second, of course. Because I always have to ask anyone in my position, the institution has to always ask, is he being truthful? Is he duping me? Am I simply being duped by a very clever individual and senior member of Al-Qaeda so that he does protect the information that we need? And am I being played for a fool? That was something that I had to weigh consciously in every question that he asked.
He did tell you on a number of occasions, if you will just read or look at the documents that I had with me when I was arrested, you'll understand a lot more about me.
Well, this was yet another one of the crazy Kafkaesque things. I became Franz Kafka, frankly, for several months.
Can't be a pleasant experience to be Franz Kafka.
So I was asking him some questions one day. This is weeks into the interrogation, as I recall. And he said, sort of in a matter-of-fact way, he said, well, I can answer that question. Just show me the documents, you know, all my files, which you have, because you took them from me when you kidnapped me off the street. And I had to try to have a poker face because no one – that was the first I had ever heard about it. And I thought, well, wouldn't that have been nice to know as the lead interrogator that we have this man's personal files? But no one had ever told me. So I engaged in a months-long futile effort to convince the institution that it would make sense for the interrogator to have the files of the man I was interrogating. And the answer consistently was – to my request, please send me the documents, was, yes, we can do that. We will send them back to headquarters. It will only take 6 to 8 weeks. But headquarters was thousands and thousands of miles away. It served no purpose at all, and I never achieved anything in that regard.
Do you think the documents were lost?
No. Others have asked me if this was sort of this devious, malicious plan to keep from proving that the guy was not as guilty as the institution said. And I don't believe that for a second. That's not the case. I know the institution, and it was simply a bungle and then a resource issue. And where the documents were, I do understand it would have been difficult for that office to send an officer for a week or 10 days, it would have taken, to travel with them as a courier. Mm-hmm. They couldn't afford to do that. I had an entire team with me. I never succeeded in sending one of my people there. I could not go because if I left for 10 days, the entire operation would have just frozen. So it became this absurd situation where I could not overcome bureaucratic inertia and resources, and I never got them.
And just to clarify, it simply wouldn't have been secure to have them reproduced electronically in some technology and presented to you that way.
Well, I think I did attempt to have that done and found that it would have been a monumental job and something that technically we couldn't do, as I recall, in a secure way. I think that's correct. So it was one of these situations where you can't get there from here, and unless I could get there, I couldn't make anything make any sense.
Glenn L. Carl is my guest. His new book is called The Interrogator, An Education. Let's go to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. First on the line, we have Matt in Burleson. Hello, Matt.
Hi.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
Yes, I'm about halfway through the audio version of the book, and it's very, very interesting. But I had a couple of questions for the author. The first one is, how do you feel about the level of redaction? Being the audio version, seems like every third or fourth word in the book is redaction going through some areas, and it leaves you feeling confused a lot of times.
Well, I'm sorry about the confusion. It's been a nightmare of that, actually. Of my initial 100,000-word manuscript, the CIA took out about 40,000 words. And over 2 years, I managed to get a number put back in and to write around some others. And I thought, gosh, you know, if I leave these redactions in, the poor reader is just going to be so turned off that no one will ever buy this thing. My editors thought, in fact, they said, no, it's quite useful or helpful for the reader to see the Never Never Land that you entered and all of the issues that they don't want you to talk about, because the narrative still is holds together well and is strong enough that is enlightening. And I think, happily, that many have found that that's the case, but I was certainly disheartened and struggled for a long time over all of the redactions.
Well, I don't know how you handle it in the audio version of the book, but I have the text version, which is what I read to prepare for this interview. And in many spots, you have a footnote at the bottom of the page, not sort of revealing exactly what was taken out, but explaining why certain portions have been removed.
Yeah, at one point I arrive at the most secret and intense interrogation facility that I call Hotel California in the book. It had a different name, of course. And the agency wouldn't let me describe what it was like or measures taken that were security measures around it. So I had a footnote that said, you know, the paragraph above that's blacked out describes security measures. I was concerned for my safety because I felt exposed or something to that effect. So I at least attempt to give the gist. I can't say that we had, you know, 17-foot fences or barking dogs or whatever.
Can you talk a little bit about the process when you write a book that you are aware that the CIA, I'm guessing, would prefer you hadn't written at all? You know, how closely do you work with the official who will be redacting the book, and what's the sort of appeal process and give and take like?
Well, actually, officers from the Directorate of Operations, you know, what I was, we do not have First Amendment rights.
Mm-hmm.
That every other American has. The Supreme Court decided that. So by law, anything I write for the rest of my life, I must submit to the CIA for review. They then will send back the manuscript, and they took out 40% of it. And then we have a series of sit-down meetings or electronic communications. And I say, come on, you can't take that out. That's not fair. And they'll say, well, why? And if I can justify how it does not endanger sources or methods, then they are supposed to put it back in. Sometimes they did that, and other times they didn't. But it took me 2 years of arguing. To give two silly examples, at one point I said, and I managed to get this in the book, I called somebody a gibbering fool, and they took that out. And I said, well, how is that a source or a method? And it's not, but they took it out anyway. I quoted Rudyard Kipling, and they took that out, and so on and so forth. And they can't, but they did. And, you know, they hold the cards.
Well, another thing that remains out of the book is something that I think is very obvious to anyone who reads it, which is that the language in which these interviews were conducted. You don't have to comment either way, but I will go on record as to say that a reader would assume that language was Arabic. Can you talk, at least without confirming or denying that, about why something that no one who reads the book wouldn't be able to figure out would be removed?
Well, they argued it's even a little more silly or perverse than the way you framed it. The agency argued that if a reader knew the languages that I speak, they could work out where I was. And I responded that dozens and dozens of countries in the world speak the languages that I speak. But they took it out anyway. Nonetheless, anyone who does a little Googling, I think, of me can work out pretty quickly what the languages are that I speak. And if you ask me right now, I would tell you. It's just sort of crazy, but they took it out.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go back to the phones now. This time we will speak with Dink in Fort Worth. Hey, Dink.
Yeah. This is a very interesting subject, and I go way back. I was thinking of all the great movies I saw that had inquisitors in them, or interrogators, Jack Hawkins and Alex Guinness in The Prisoner of 1955, for example. But the style and method of the interrogators is the subject of great fascination. And, in fact, I was in a seminar, and catch this, if you will, about 40-some years ago, on the literature, and this is classic literature, of interrogators, particularly like in Crime and Punishment. And then later on, I had the pleasure of spending 3 hours with Captain Clint Peoples of the Texas Rangers and his stories of interrogation. So there is a methodology that gets the goods rather on, ultimately, but by just patiently waiting and listening and asking a question here and there.
You were really influenced, Glenn, by a document that was published by the United States government I guess it's the Korean War era. Is that right?
I think it was published after the Korean War, but it derives from the Korean War. It's called, the code name was KUBARK, or KU-BARK, it doesn't matter. It's the genesis of the interrogation methods that were used during my time and all during the post 9/11 and well before. And the military and the CIA found during the Korean War, oh my goodness, look, we have GIs who are signing these confessions and who are denouncing America, and how can this be? And they had terrible times. They were considered traitors, and these poor fellows weren't traitors at all. They had been tortured. And so the military thought, well, how can these good citizens do this? What happened to them? And so they looked at the methods that the North Koreans used. And then they found that the methods that the North Koreans used were based upon methods that the Soviet intelligence service had used on Jewish intellectual dissidents in the show trial.
You know, I'm going to have to jump in for a second. I'm sorry to interrupt you. We have to take a quick break, but we'll come back to this in just a moment. Glenn L. Carl is my guest. His new book is called The Interrogator and Education. Our number, 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is CIA veteran Glenn L. Carl. He retired as Deputy National Intelligence Officer for Transnational Threats. 4 years later, he is the author of the new book, The Interrogator and Education. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org. And Glenn, before the break, you were talking about the origins of the methods in the KUBARK manual.
I'm sorry, I probably am giving more detail than anyone would care to hear.
But, no, this is great.
But so the gist is that the origins of this guidance manual on interrogation that became the Bible for the CIA and the U.S. military go back to the Soviet intelligence service in the 1930s and the North Koreans in the 1950s. And the method, which is quite perverse, because the objective they had was to extract a confession, not to get someone to cooperate and provide information. A totally different thing. But that became the guiding document for how we go about setting up our interrogation facilities.
And the confession is different than information because, to provide a confession, you'll do anything to keep yourself out of pain or physical harm, which is different from a longstanding relationship that might yield information over months or even years.
Absolutely. The part of my training, when I was an officer candidate, essentially, part of all officer training in the CIA, all officers, is to be subjected to interrogation and using the methods that we're alluding to. It's actually a very useful part of the training because if ever a CIA officer were captured and tortured, there are ways to cope with these terrible things. That's useful. What I learned, however, was from my personal experience, it's very easy to break somebody down. It's shockingly easy, I thought. But that didn't make me more willing to cooperate. That just made me angry, angry and miserable. And that's not a good environment to inhabit in order to feel like cooperating.
So what was going through your mind when your time with Captus was complete? Because to your knowledge, he was not released from captivity.
Well, I know he wasn't, actually. It's part of it's a terrible story from beginning to end, actually, where everything went wrong. As my time progressed and I became more and more convinced that this man was not what we had assessed him to be, really, and that the methods we were using were more than objectionable, I opposed them, and our assessment of the threat was wrong, I thought, well, we have to get this right. It's our duty to right errors if we can. It's not acceptable that we simply say, well, you know, we're at war, collateral damage. No, no. Even if this fellow is an enemy, part of our obligation is to try to get things right, especially if there are lives involved. So I argued as strongly as I could that we should let this man go. There are all sorts of other elements. There are other people who were kidnapped and so on, whom I thought needed to be let go also in the operation. And I recommended that as strongly as I possibly could, and I had no effect whatsoever. So I was very disturbed. But I weighed, what can I do that will have any effect? And anyone who's been in the military or a large organization, I think, will identify with my conclusion that although there are formal channels that one can take, at best, one will have a Pyrrhic victory, and more likely, one will accomplish not much of anything. So I tried, but failed, and I was one voice against the assessed, the collective assessment of the institution and the administration, and so I accomplished not much of anything in the end.
What accounts do you think for that institutional, rigidity with regard to someone has been assumed to be guilty from the beginning of something very large, and therefore that perception doesn't change despite the intelligence that you were able to provide and the nuanced discussions that you were able to have with this captive?
Yeah, it's one of the fascinating dynamics and discoveries I had in the case, and in this instance, one of the tragic ones, too. Once an institution comes to a settled view, the collective view, that becomes the orthodoxy. And anyone who challenges the orthodoxy is an apostate. And so since the experts say that a certain point is correct, if you challenge that, well, by definition, you're challenging the expert who knows what he's talking about. And who are you to challenge the collective wisdom of the entire intelligence community of the United States? It just doesn't make sense. And anyone who would have to adjudicate this would say, okay, well, here's this guy. He's been working really hard. He's probably very, very tired, a guy named Carl. And he says, this is all made out of whole cloth. And then you have the entire institution that's been working on this for years. Well, okay, thanks a lot, Glenn. Good luck. And that's it's a very difficult challenge to overcome an accepted view. And I tried, but that's how it played out.
Well, do you think that accepted view is calcified by the need to preserve power and respect for the organization, or is it about fear?
Well, I think both of those are factors, and I think there are other factors, too. I mean, this will sound this is quite unkind, but careerism plays a role, too. And this was one of this case, the Captus case, I call it, was one of the signal successes of the CIA and of the United States government in the War on Terror. And if it were all undone, everyone would look, frankly, like a fool. That's impolitic to say. But so, we don't want that to happen. And so let's make this work. That's how it played out.
There have been, Glenn, a lot of criticisms following 9/11 and the things that have happened since then that have stated that the United States and its intelligence services were really caught unawares at a time when we should have understood what was coming. What do you think about those criticisms?
Well, that I don't agree with at all. I mean, George Tenet, former director of Central Intelligence, said many times that all of the lights were blinking red and the agency was almost literally jumping up and down, trying to warn policymakers that we would be attacked. That's a fact. I know that's a fact. I was working on these issues. And President Clinton, this is also a fact, increased the resources devoted to counterterrorism by orders of magnitude, not just a few percent, but by hundreds of percent. So the intelligence community was very seized on the threat. Now, putting all of the pieces together for 9/11 specifically, obviously it happened, and you know that's terrible. But the agency was quite aware of the threat and was working very consciously trying to counter it well before 9/11.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to Jim in Dallas. Hello, Jim.
Hi, dear. I wanted to ask a question and then follow up with another question. Why did you specifically write this book? And secondly, what would happen, in your opinion, if we just simply never questioned prisoners so they could, and so that they would not be able to mislead us and we would not be able to misjudge them? Thank you.
Well, thanks. Why? It's a good question why I wrote the book, and I think it's really important. Because I and all of us were in a found ourselves in a terrible dilemma. I was one of the few people involved directly in our interrogation policies post 9/11 for a brief time, but nonetheless directly. Most Americans think, okay, we're taking measures that we need to take in order to protect us. That's a sensible thing. What were the consequences of the program, though? It's what happened to the individual whom I interrogated is a personal issue, you know, for him and for the agency. But the larger issue is, what has all of this done to us? And that is why I wrote the book, because we were ordered to use enhanced interrogation techniques. They were authorized, and that's what we were told to do. But what does our Constitution say? And what are the it says no cruel and unusual punishment. The definition became anything that is not severe and lasting was not torture. Well, that means almost anything, because almost nothing is really lasting. That's very disturbing. And the attitudes of the American public, polls show, now much more broadly support the use of torture by American officials in order to protect Americans. I find that, frankly, profoundly un-American. That is not the flag that I think any of us pledge allegiance to, or that I took an oath to preserve and protect. That's not the America that any of us want to live in. And I wrote the book so that people will know what we have done to ourselves. Now, what would have happened if we didn't question the people? We have to interrogate these people, of course, but we can do it in a successful way, the way the FBI has been doing it for decades, without using measures that undermine the principles that we're trying to protect.
Does it appear to you that we have made a permanent shift in this country toward acceptance of the idea that torture is par for the course in these investigations?
Oh, this is one of the reasons I wrote the book. I'm profoundly disturbed by this. I think the answer is yes. I saw a poll, I think USA Today did it a month or two ago, that showed, if I get the gist correct, Americans who are 35 years old and above, a majority of them find, of course, torture is un-American. We don't do that. We're the good guys. We oppose that. Americans who are 35 and below find, well, under certain circumstances, sure, it's okay for American officials to take whatever step is necessary to protect us. Torture can be okay. Besides, it's just them. It's not us. And I find that horrifying.
Well, Glenn, I have to say, you're not the first person we've interviewed on this show who has said quite openly that torture does not work particularly well or at all in trying to get useful evidence from detainees. Do you think that some of our appetite for torture is about vengeance more than about collection of useful information and protection?
I do. I think it's a very visceral thing that here we have, you know, there are 3,000 Americans who are moldering in Manhattan, three of whom were people I knew. This makes anyone angry. Of course I want to go out and stop and catch the people who do that. So the feeling then is I will be as tough as I need to be to stop them. That makes sense. We have to be smart and effective, not schoolboy tough in a schoolyard. You don't undermine your own values and fail in your objectives because you're angry. And that's what has happened. We need to be smart and aggressive. They are not the same things.
We have time for one more quick call. We'll speak with Matt in Arlington. Hi, Matt.
Hey, I'm a criminal justice major at UTA, and I'm just wondering, how did you get into this job? Were you recruited? Did you start somewhere else in the CIA?
Well, how I got into the interrogation was I was, as our host was saying, I was doing another task, a non-operational task at headquarters, and there was an urgent need for an experienced senior operations officer who had excellent language ability in certain languages and who could disappear for 90 days. And there aren't a lot of people who can do that, so I could. How I got into that's how I got into the interrogation, which I had never done before. How I got into the career is a whole other tale, but I graduated from college and started the normal business route and thought I wanted to do something that would challenge me more, and I thought, what's the wildest thing I can think of that still is responsible? And I thought, well, I'll be a spy. And so I approached the agency and got myself in.
How have your views evolved regarding the existential threat posed by jihadist violence to the United States since 9/11, based on your work with the CIA and also the consideration you have given all of this since your retirement 4 years ago?
Well, they evolved quite a bit. As I describe the evolution in the book, in 2001, I shared the standard view, which was that al-Qaeda was global, coherent, aggressive, and a dramatic, serious threat. And it is has been, remains global, and there are al-Qaeda people trying to kill us. That remains a fact, whom we need to stop. But the overall nature of the threat and size, the scope, I came to see in completely different terms. Al-Qaeda was never more than 400 to 600 individuals, of whom maybe 30 are competent enough to plan an operation. Now, it only takes one person to kill many, but that's a different kind of threat, level of threat, than the threat perception we had that justified sending all of our armed forces and all of our intelligence officers to focus all of their time on what amounts to 400 to 500 people.
Was it a difficult decision for you to put on the line, if not your professional reputation, at least the relationships with the colleagues that you'd worked for so long within the CIA?
Yes, that is painful, actually, I guess not surprisingly. I think very highly of most of my colleagues. Some of them have said to me, you know, Glenn, you're aiding and abetting the enemy. And others, and happily more, have said to me, Glenn, you have to write this book. The American public has to know what we've done to ourselves. So please do it. But it has been hard.
Glenn L. Carl spent 23 years working for the CIA. He retired in 2007 as Deputy National Intelligence Officer for Transnational Threats. His new book is called The Interrogator and Education. Glenn, it's been a fascinating hour. Thank you so much for spending it with us.
Thank you. I've been honored. Thanks a lot.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
Think production team includes engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.